Today, our Christmas Box of Delights with Tarek Brooker. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Christmas Eve, Friday afternoon, Tarek's here. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, hanging in there. Bit of an interesting week this week. Believe me, you don't want to go through my week again. But anyway, it's great to catch up with you and to be able to share some slides, some thoughts about this past year, but also what's looking like being an interesting 2022.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember the first time we had a conversation, you know, on through this medium, and, you know, we talked about how there'd be interesting times ahead, and that was, I believe, towards the end of 2019. And unfortunately, we were more right than I thought we would be.
Yes, well, they always say living in interesting times, and you know, the more things go on, the more they seem to me to spin out of control. And talking about spin, of course, all the political parties just get more and more spun up to try and actually make a political point rather than dealing with the real issues they should be dealing with. So it really is very interesting times, and whether you believe central banks have any clue at all as to what's really going on, I think another interesting point.
It sort of boggles the mind at this point, really. Like, if you look at, you know, say producer price inflation, I think is a fantastic one, and that's occurring not just in Australia but around the world. I mean, the recent PMI data has basically said that price pressures are, even in here in Australia, at their greatest level ever in the history of these surveys. And even if you look, you know, say to Europe, the Spanish producer price index is rising at 33% per year, and it just blows the 1970s inflationary period absolutely out of the water.
Yeah, and I do think that people need to go back and look at that 1970s scenario, because for the first 3 or 4 years, all the central banks were talking about transitory inflation. It's not a problem. It's not serious. You know, it'll dissipate. And then it went higher and higher and higher, and they started sort of, oh, well, actually, maybe we should redefine some metrics. And then they said, no, actually, we've got a real problem. It feels horribly similar.
It does, but I think one of the interesting things this time, though, is just we don't have the ability to absorb that inflation in the way that we could, and the way that we did in the 1970s and the early 1980s. Because, like, you look, say, for example, you look at something like household savings rates. There just isn't that slack in household budgets to be able to absorb this. I'm not going to say relative ease, because obviously the 1970s was a very challenging period for a lot of people, but not in the same way, with the same, you know, sort of ability to absorb it as households did, you know, back then, because there just isn't that much slack these days. You know, people just, you know, we've got just in time, you know, supply chains, and we've got just enough household budgets.
Well, it is interesting because, of course, everybody's claiming in the mainstream that we've got these massive savings that everyone's been putting aside over the last 2 years because they haven't been travelling, they haven't been buying a lot of stuff. But the trouble is, you've got to look at the distribution of those savings, right? Sure, there are certain people who have actually done really, really well, and their stock portfolios have performed and their properties have performed and they're feeling relatively wealthy. But there is a huge swathe of middle Australia and beyond that have no savings. They can't even, you know, meet 1 month's cash flow if they stop working. And so the average number, which everybody quotes, completely derails the true narrative of what's going on. But it's very convenient for the politicians.
It is, but that, I think, is emblematic of the issues that exist more broadly. You know, like, It's just this aggregate measure that they go for. You know, it's like, okay, GDP has gone up X percent. This has happened, that's happened, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's it. And it's just this very, very broad overview. But, I mean, it's like what you talked about with Leif Van Onselen from on your stream on Tuesday night, you know, how basically this isn't flowing through to the average person. You know, when you look at it in per capita, you know, household, you know, real disposable incomes, when you look at it in just in pure per capita GDP, it really doesn't look that good. And then when you factor in that a lot of this stuff is coming from the mining sector and coming from, you know, education, tourism, and the things that were actually doing relatively well pre-COVID, you know, for the average person, things really don't look that great. And, you know, not to go off on a giant tangential rant, but the thing is, if you look around the world, if you're an asset holder over the last 12 to 18, well, last say 2 years, you've got absolutely screwed. You know, the house that you wanted or needed has gone up immeasurably. Your cost of living has risen almost certainly by more than the cost of inflation in the vast majority of nations around the world. And you've still got these idiot central bankers and politicians going, oh, but look how much nominal incomes have grown. It's like, well, no one cares about that if the cost of living is rising faster.
Absolutely right. Well, it, you know, goes back to measure certain things and then present them in a certain way. But of course, it's all done with a political overlay on it to try and actually convince people to vote for them for the next election rather than dealing with the underlying issues. And, you know, I consider my surveys in spades. There are people who are really up against it. And then, of course, they're now beginning twitchy because their incomes really aren't doing much at all. And even the Reserve Bank is saying income growth is going to be pretty slow. But the costs are rising very fast. And we've now got this movement up in interest rates. And some people are already seeing higher rates. More people will see that later, I think, down the track. The, you know, real issue is the pressure on households has probably been more extreme over the last little while. But it's going to get worse, not better. And I just can't see any way out of the sort of circle we've got ourselves into.
Well, what I find really fascinating about just the pressures on households is how understated they are when you look at different sources. You know, like the ABS says that rental price pressures are relatively minimal. And part of that is because they don't count things outside the capital cities. But if you look at Louis Christopher's data from SQM Research, who you've had on the show recently, you know, you're talking about very nearly more rental price pressures occurring in the capital cities in the past month than the ABS has seen in the past year. And that's just nuts. I mean, obviously, you know, inflation's taking off, the cost of living's taking off, and, you know, we have this horribly lagged data because of reasons. And it's just kind of ridiculous because they're telling people, oh, no, it's fine, you know, things aren't so bad, but it's not what people are experiencing. And I would really dearly love to see a breakdown of consumer confidence by wealth demographics, by income demographics, because if you look at the consumer confidence surveys in the US and in Europe, when they're broken down to that demographic level, things are much, much less rosy than even the relatively dire consumer confidence data suggests.
Absolutely. Well, if you look at the HILDA data, which came out recently, but HILDA data is still 3 years old, right? And it's the HILDA data that, of course, the Reserve Bank turns to when it wants to justify its own position. The second point there is that the ABS last week published the new revisions to CPI, and they've actually reduced the weighting for housing, right? And the reason is because over the last 18 months ago, rents went down for some people. I mean, it's ridiculous because it shows you that the CPI calculation, as officially reported, has very little to do with reality.
Well, I think that paints an even more concerning picture of what we're seeing with inflation, not just in Australia, but around the world, because this is the number that they've cooked up after all these revisions, after all these different, you know, changes in methodology, etc. I mean, like, you know, say for in the US with owner's equivalent rent, where people estimate how much their property can be rented for, which is just insane. I mean, you know, okay, you know, Bob and Barry, you know, you both own houses. How much can it be rented for? Oh, we don't know, $450 a week. And that is a massive input to the US CPI. It's just insane. And yet still, even though they're undercounting it, even though there's this fanciful way of measuring things, US inflation is still going through the roof. And it's a similar story around the world. And you know, it's no wonder why consumer confidence has been tanking for quite some time now in a lot of different countries. And we're just lucky here in Australia that, you know, the government's thrown far more money at the economy relative to the situation with the virus compared with around the world.
No, that's true. I mean, ours is pretty much one of the biggest stimulus packages, I think, of most Western countries, if you look at it on a comparable basis. And the other point there, of course, is that the whole CPI discussion in the US, they're already talking about making further changes to the CPI to take out variable items, right, to try and actually get to the underlying CPI. I mean, why don't you just make up a little Excel spreadsheet with the at rand function, right, and just create a number, because it'll be as accurate as anything they've got there at the moment.
The narrative coming out of the US government, you know, their media teams and elements of the US mainstream media is just disturbing, frankly. Like, there was this chart released the other day by the White House pointing out that, you know, over the last 6 weeks, the cost of gasoline is down by 12 cents. And it's like, yeah, but it's gone up an absolute shitload. This is like the greatest chart crime of the 21st century. And it's been caused by the Omicron variant, by, you know, concerns about lockdowns. And that's why oil prices are down. It's not Biden's magical powers. And it's just, oh, it's just ridiculous. But people are buying it. You know, at least some people are. I mean, 87% of Democrats still approve of Biden, despite only 29% of independent voters. But, you know, I mean, you know, what do we know?
Well, we know data, right? So you've got some charts. And I think the point is that we come back to our charts and we come back to the data, because effectively that tells of such a different narrative to, you know, all the spinning from politicians and elsewhere and mainstream media and elsewhere, that that's why we come back to the data. So Why don't we push the button and bring your charts on?
Righto. All right. Well, we got the nice little money printer spluttering here as Jerome Powell considers his tapering and, you know, potentially rate hikes as early as next year. As early as Q1 next year, according to some predictions, and about a 50% chance of a rate hike in March.
I know.
Which would really put the cat amongst the pigeons.
Yep. And that little chart, little cartoon says it so well, doesn't it? It's hilarious.
I just love how excited the bear is. Okay. Now, this one is to produce the price inflation charts, which I was mentioning earlier. And basically, the one on the right is for Spain. And you can see the 1970s there on the right. And it's just gone to the moon. It's absolutely just skyrocketed. And don't get me wrong, part of this is the EU energy crisis, which is currently ongoing. And the price of electricity and gas has risen to untold new heights. I mean, it is literally cheaper for a lot of, not cheaper, it is more profitable now for companies who are in energy intensive industries in parts of Europe to sell their electricity allocations that they've already bought and paid for than to actually make things, which is ironically causing even more inflation and even more supply chain issues. And, you know, it's just not a very pretty picture. And on the left there, we've got the US producer price inflation, and that's at its highest level on record. I will say that the records for this particular data set don't go all the way back to the 1970s, but it is still very, very high compared with the last 35 or 40 years of consistent data. And if even a fraction of that, especially, you know, for the likes of Spain and Germany, who are both having massive issues with producer price inflation, if even a fraction of that, even if, you know, 20% of that is passed on to consumers, It's curtains. It needs to be rate hikes. It really is that simple.
Yeah, well, in the point about the producer price is that it feeds in ultimately to the retail price or the CPI, right? So it's effectively upstream, but downstream. It's interesting that a lot of the recent wholesalers and retailers in the US said we're not having any issues passing on prices downstream. So you can expect a lot of this to hit real consumers.
Indeed, and it's not a pretty picture. And one of the things, I will make one prediction right here that I will literally guarantee will happen. And that's not often I do that. I don't think I've ever done that on this show, but here we go. There are going to be people who are going to celebrate like there's no tomorrow, and all these analysts who are going to say, oh, look, producer price inflation is coming down. And it's like, yes, it will come down, because it's not going to be 33% forever. Because if it was, we'd be up the creek without a paddle.
Spot on. Yeah, but it can still come back a little bit and still be significantly higher than where we're used to. And
exactly.
When you remember, what are they targeting? What, 2%?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it was Oxford Economics who came out yesterday who said that it's unlikely that US inflation is going to get below 3% in 2022, which basically means rate hikes galore through 2022. So it's going to get interesting.
And the big question, of course, is, will rate hikes break in, you know, not break as in crash, but break as in slow inflation? Because if, in fact, the inflationary pressures are predominantly supply chain related, the question, of course, is to what extent lifting interest rates is going to have any impact?
Well, I think that, to be honest, I mean, my working theory at this point is that it will hit markets before it hits the real economy. I mean, the actual impact of rising interest rates on a dollar for dollar basis, like say, I did the math the other day, and on Australia, it's under $5 billion for one rate hike in terms of the impact on household budgets. But by the same token, you're talking about a country that is running a $103 billion deficit, as predicted by the no, sorry, $106 billion, as predicted by the recent mid-year economic update by the government, and we're pulling $93 billion a year in home equity out of our homes. So a $5 billion increase in expenditure for households is really a bit of a drop in the ocean compared with all that stimulus. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that balances out, especially because the wealthy do hold such a large amount of cash. If they feel comfortable spending that, that could potentially blunt any impact of rising rates, and rates may have to rise higher than they otherwise would have.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it goes back to the fundamental issue that you can't just take these aggregate averages, right? So there are some people that will do quite well. Some people can be insulated from those rate rises, but a lot won't. And that's why these statistics are very important. So your first prediction is that we're going to see interest rates in the US going up.
That well, I mean, I think that's a bit of a given at this point. I mean, unless of course something breaks in the markets. I mean, rates are going to have to rise, or you see, basically the entire economy crap itself as issues are resolved. But either way, things are going to be interesting in 2022. But I will say the one prediction I will say with certainty is you're going to see a lot of people being short-sighted and celebrating falling PPI and
Yeah.
eventually falling CPI numbers once all this stuff feeds through.
Yep. Okay.
Now, I like this one because it basically shows that, for all the hype, for all the US economies going to the moon, blah, 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 in real terms, and this is on a seasonally adjusted basis, I might add as well, US retail sales peaked more than 6 months ago. It peaked back in March, and oh, sorry, it was March or April. And that was on the back of further stimulus. And since then, it's been in this downtrend. And I mean, we've seen a little bit of an uptick in the last few months and then back down again. But it just goes to show that, a reversion to trend is going to hit the US economy quite hard. And people aren't, I mean, it's all in good for them to say, oh, headline retail sales are up XYZ amount. But in inflation adjusted terms, people are just buying the same amount of stuff that they were last month. It's just the fact that the stuff costs more.
Absolutely. And of course, there is going to be an interesting inflection point where those increased costs mean that people will start perhaps spending a little less because they look at the prices and think, oh, that's a bit steep. So it could be quite interesting to see how that goes forward. And the other point, I suppose, on the retail side of it, there's a bit of a switch, isn't there, between services and goods. There's very big purchases of goods earlier on, more purchases of services now. But with the Omicron buzzing around, maybe some of those services will disappear again.
Well, that is one of the risks going forward. And it's interesting as well, because if you look at the survey data in terms of spending intentions, particularly around Christmas, lower income households are cutting their budgets. Lower income households are planning, less extravagant gatherings. They're planning, smaller gatherings. They're planning to spend less money on gifts. But this isn't occurring in the higher income brackets. In some higher income brackets, they're planning on spending significantly more because, well, Jerome and the Fed have got their back and they've got the wealth effect going up the wazoo. So it's that real bifurcation that's occurring within the economy. And I mean, we're going to see, next year and into 2023, if you can run an economy on the wealthy spending on extravagant things and not on, the spending of everyday consumers. And to be honest, I think without additional stimulus, without them throwing more money at it, I don't think they can.
Well, certainly the distribution of wealth, I mean, it's most extreme in the US, but it's quite extreme here in Australia now. So there's a small proportion of people with massive capacity to spend. But, frankly, they've got so much money that they've been spending it anyway. I mean, it's not like, things have fundamentally changed. So if you come down the income scale and the wealth scale, that's when you start hitting all the speed bumps with people's incomes being compressed, with costs going up, and with mortgage pressure as well. So I think we're going to see considerable slowing in areas of the economy. And as you say, it'll be an interesting question as to whether the very wealthy can keep the whole system up, or whether in fact basically they're going to get dragged down by it.
Well, I mean, if you work as a private jet pilot, or you work, you know, manufacturing super yachts, I think your job's going to be probably pretty safe for the moment. But for the rest of us, I'm not so sure.
Well, I wouldn't know. I don't go in those lofty areas.
No, neither do I. Okay, this is, well, this sort of just illustrates the issue that we were discussing previously at the start of the show regarding the difference between interest rates and the CPI. And basically, it just shows that over time, the CPI and inflation have had a, you know, sorry, CPI and interest rates have had a relatively you know, sort of close relationship. At least they've mirrored each other. While in recent times, we've seen inflation go to the moon in relative terms. I mean, the highest level since the early 1980s. But obviously, the Fed is sitting on its hands despite inflation rocketing. And it's all and good for them, of them to say it's transitory, for them to say that things are going to return to trend. But the problem is that the people on the lower rungs of the social and economic ladder, this is going to take years of real wage growth to undo. You know, their spending is going to be hampered by this for years to come because they've seen their rents rise somewhere between 10 and 17% over the past 12 months. And now a lot of them are now locked out of home ownership due to rising housing prices. So this is doing long-term damage because it's going to take real wage growth to start to mend this. And real wage growth at the moment, and even going forward, may not happen. And that's one of the real big issues here as well, because this is the threat. This is the 1970s style scenario, because if people do start demanding higher wages to keep up with this cost of the living, that's when you start to see that inflationary feedback loop that the Fed and the rest of the central banks really, really fear.
Yeah, well, the truth is, of course, that inflation is rising a lot faster than income growth. So people are still going backwards, right? And it's that net effect of going backwards, which is ultimately the break, which will create the problem. And that's precisely what happened in the 70s.
Indeed, and we're starting to see some early signs of that in the US. You know, you've seen the Kellogg's workers go on strike, the people at the John Deere factory. You know, you're starting to see this in big business. And you know, that is usually where it starts, because you know it's easier to go after the, you know, the sort of faceless corporation than to go ask the small business owner for a pay rise. But once that starts to, if and when that feeds through the economy, that's when things start to get very, very challenging, and both for the Fed and for just everyday people.
But the solution here in Australia is to open the floodgates and bring in very cheap migrants who can be paid much less. And that means you can still create the growth.
Yeah, and we'll just have our purchasing power crushed and our wages crushed, and you know, everything will be fine as long as housing prices keep rising.
Yeah, heard that somewhere before.
Speaking of housing prices, this is some interesting charts from Wall Street on housing prices in Canada, and they're ironically showing some relatively similar trends to housing prices here in Australia, because you've got cities here in Australia like Brisbane and Adelaide that are both still showing very strong growth. But then you've got cities like Melbourne where housing prices have started to fall, which is really quite interesting considering, you know, the hype that you know, this was the housing boom that was going to last for 1,000 years. And it's just a bit, you know, ridiculous, because nothing lasts forever. You know, we've had the hit from lower interest rates. We've had the hit from stimulus. But this is going to fade in time, and we just don't know how quickly it's going to fade and what impact it's going to have. You know, you look, say, here at the chart on the left for Ottawa. You know, housing prices are already falling, and they've been falling for a few months now. And it really just makes you think, how long is it going to be until we start seeing this across much of Australia?
Well, it was interesting. The Reserve Bank of New Zealand put their forecast out for house price growth. And of course, it's been very strong, up 30%, right? But their forecast was it was going to come back down significantly on average and aggregate. And there is some very interesting early signs now of price pressure really starting to exhibit itself in a lot of markets, and people having to accept lower prices, negotiating prior to auction rather than at auction to try and get a sale. And interestingly, of course, the data lags, so you don't see it until it's a bit later. But certainly on the ground data that I've got and talking to various people out in the market, prices have changed dramatically. And it's not just in the high growth areas or indeed the top end of the market, it's pretty broad across most places. And even areas of Brisbane, which, as you say, were very strong, looks as though they might be topping as well. So it will be really interesting to see what happens over the next 3 months. You know, will it pick up again after Christmas into the new year? Or are we actually now at a sea change driven by the fact that banks are lending slightly less than previously, interest rates are going up, first-time buyers are coming off, the amount of stimulus in the system has dropped? Although I still think that the government could throw another bunch of stimulus at first-time buyers before the election to say, see, we're not going to let prices drop. We'll see.
Well, it wouldn't be surprising. And they've done it before. And, I mean, I would be very surprised if they never did it again. And just on the point of housing prices, the truth is we don't really understand exactly why prices have risen. We don't. And what I mean by that is that, okay, you know, how can we break it down? How much of it was interest rate? What percentage of the prices rising was interest rates? What percentage was the complete imbalance between supply and demand due to the pandemic and people not wanting people in their homes and any number of other reasons? The truth is we don't know. We don't know exactly how these factors have interacted with each other, how, and, you know, whether or not these conditions are going to be continued, because the truth is a lot of people overpaid compared with what they wanted to pay on a lot of homes across all of Australia because there was just huge demand. And if you look at the levels of stock on the market, you know, outside of inner city apartments in terms of freestanding homes, which I know is Edwin's, you know, favorite metric, there just hasn't been enough stock, put simply. And that has just created these bidding wars, this absolute frenzy of, am I going to get a home? Am I going to get a home? This FOMO. And the truth is, we don't know how much that's put a rocket under prices and how much it's going to impact prices when we take that away. Because it's just this unprecedented thing. And, you know, to once again, you know, repeat myself, we don't know how this is going to play out. I don't think anyone really does because we just don't understand it all that well.
Well, certainly I'm not sure the Reserve Bank understands it. I mean, their modelling is pretty off, as you might say. What we do know is that generally when interest rates go lower, house prices go higher. When lending standards go looser, house prices go higher. And when there is significant demand over supply, house prices tend to go higher. The reverse of all those is also true.
Well, that's what we may see in 2022, but we're just going to have to wait and see.
Yep.
Okay, now, I know that this graph has been done to death, and, you know, but it just bears worth saying that the supply chain issues are not getting better. I know that there's the hype train that, you know, 2022 is going to be better and everything's going to be fantastic and yada blah blah, but it's not. Things are actually, in actual fact, still continuing to worsen. Things will get better in time, don't get me wrong, mostly because eventually high prices will be the cure for high prices, and that will play a significant role in fixing things. But it's not happening. And to be completely frank with you, there's the issues in China at the moment as more cities go into lockdown, and that's gonna, you know, you've got port cities on the border with Vietnam heading into lockdown. You've got Xi'an in lockdown. You've got cities across China considering these measures. And Omicron, as we know, you know, is potentially much, much more virulent. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, hospital outcomes and all that stuff, but that doesn't matter to the Chinese government. What matters to the Chinese government is zero COVID. And if that continues to be the case into Q1 and potentially Q2 2022, we're going to have the same supply chain issues that we've had over the last year, and perhaps even worse, because we're not starting from, you know, sort of Q1 2020 anymore, where things were okay and, you know, the system was fine. We're starting from a place where things are already bad, and the virus is potentially making them even worse.
Absolutely. Well, you know, it's like once you get out of cycle and things are all in the wrong place, you know, you can't just click your fingers and suddenly they pop back. It takes a long time to settle back. And of course, there's also this other thing in China. Of course, they've started rationing urea, which means that some of our trucks might grind to a halt. And I now hear that they're also rationing the critical ingredient to make wine. So not only can't we drive, but we can't actually make wine as well. What is the world coming to?
Well, it's just the legacy of the just-in-time supply chain of, you know, giving things to the lowest bidder. And you know, I think that is something that really needs to be talked about going forward, just not only for Australia, but around the world, because costs will rise as supply chains are reshored, as factories are moved into areas which are less likely to be impacted by geopolitical tensions, for example. You know, they're building chip factories, and I say chip, I mean semiconductors, computer chips, not the potato chip kind. and all this costs billions and billions, or tens of billions of dollars. And that's going to be passed on to consumers eventually. So, you know, that particular, you know, trend, particularly if we see this issues with China continue to rise and tensions rise even further, you know, they're going to look to guarantee their supply chains rather than leaving them at the risk of geopolitical conflict.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've said before, and we'll say it again, that China's agenda is about the future of China, not about the future of Australia.
Exactly. Now, this one I think is really interesting because, you know, there's this idea that, you know, the Fed wants to protect the market. And yes, to a degree, that's absolutely true. But if you look at the chart on the left, that's of US junk bonds and the effective yield on US junk bonds. When junk bond yields took off in February, March last year, yeah, they rose significantly, but they didn't really go into that sort of really super threatening danger zone that they did during the global financial crisis. I mean, they were still less than half where they were during the global financial crisis. Yet the thing that really, really got under the Fed's skin was the issues in the US Treasury bond market. When rather than seeing yields continue to go lower as poorer growth, as, you know, weaker inflation and all that stuff that was generally the consensus during the crash of last year was priced in, you saw this disorderly sell-off in US Treasury bonds. And, you know, there was times when bonds couldn't even catch a bid. And that is something that they cannot abide. It's something that underpins the entire global financial system. And that is the thing that they truly fear. And I think that should really be rammed home, that is the one thing that is really key to them. Because at the end of the day, that is what underpins the entire global economy, the entire system of US dollar hegemony.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you think about the potential futures, you know, will it be a strong US dollar? Will the dollar continue to, you know, rule the roost, as it were, with all the advantages that gives to the US? Or will we see an alternative coming through? Will they be able to maintain that momentum? You know, there are people who believe that we're at a very insignificant inflection point.
Well, exactly. And that's extreme. You know, that's very possible because, you know, we are at this, you know, sort of this crossroads because, you know, the truth is once you take away the stimulus, like say, for example, let's take Australia, for instance, how I was mentioning that we've got this huge budget deficit, this enormous amount of equity, mate, flowing into the economy. If we were to reset those settings to the same place they were in the year 2000, where there was very little equity, mate, in net terms being pulled out of home loans and where the budget was actually in surplus. If you take Australia magically, those settings back to the year 2000, we would have a depression tomorrow. It is literally more than 10% of GDP being ripped out of the economy like that. And that's the problem, not just in Australia, but around the world. We're addicted to this money coming from the wealth effect, from government stimulus, and just from these huge ongoing deficits. Because, you know, it's just too hard for governments to find actual growth to grow economies. So instead, they just throw more and more money at it. And that's true of central banks too, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that's right. So, you know, you can basically try and keep the momentum going by throwing more stimulus in. But of course, stimulus costs. And if rates start to go up, the cost of stimulus is also going to go up. But it's not real. And it's not actually creating sustainable growth that actually creates momentum in the broader economy. You know, look at small businesses in Australia, for example, absolutely struggling at the moment. And the latest round of Omicron is just another dampener. So The question is anybody going to actually do other than just throw more money at it? And I think the short answer is no, because they're only interested in the next election and not really anything substantive in terms of structural change ahead. Mind you, of course, structural change ahead would actually take real thinking and real creative ideas and people having to take responsibility for a longer time horizon. What they all will want, though, of course, is just short-term fixes to get over the next election, and then they can just go on playing their merry games.
Unfortunately, I'm forced to agree. I mean, the thing I think is that's important to keep in mind is that when you start talking about these huge numbers, that there needs to be some sort of frame of reference. You know, say, for example, the $93 billion that Australians pull out of their homes every year in the form of cash out, you know, equity, mate, as it's otherwise known. That is like, on paper, that's about seven times the size of Rudd's cash handouts during the global financial crisis every year. Now, that was enough, apparently, to get us out, to get us over the hump and to get us in, you know, to avoid the recession in during the global financial crisis. And yet now we're reliant on seven times that being pumped into the economy from people's homes every year. And it just goes to show just how things could be if the plate stops spinning. Because, you know, you can't take 4.6% of GDP out of the economy tomorrow without having a massive recession. It's just particularly one that would be heavily focused on the construction sector and the housing sector, because a lot of that money flows to home renovations and to up trading and to all these different, you know, sort of, you know, big, you know, big extensions and renos and all that sort of stuff. So, well, and the car, then there's also the used car side, sorry, the car industry side of things as well. So, you know, it just goes to show just how vulnerable we are without housing prices continuing to go to the moon, because otherwise eventually the plate stops spinning and there just isn't that equity to take, at least for newer homeowners.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, we've said them consistently, the problem is that the only answer they've got is to keep house prices higher to try and actually get that wealth effect coming through. But of course, you've got the big debt issue. The debt overhang is significant. And you've got the issue that it's harder and harder for people to get into the market in the first place. And it's more and more of people's money basically chasing that. And the equity mate story, which is a very important one, means that people are just getting ever bigger loans. The banks are doing well, thank you very much, that's great, so they feel happy. But you know, economically, it's ruinous.
It is. And that's not just our conclusion either, I should point out. It's the conclusion of the Bank of International Settlements. It's the conclusion of the International Monetary Fund. And believe it or not, it's also the conclusion of the Reserve Bank of Australia. And that's actually in their own papers, I might.
I was going to say, yeah, it is interesting just watching how they think about it, right? Because they are part of the problem, not the solution.
Well, exactly. And I don't know. I mean, we're going to see negative rates at some point. I mean, let's not beat around the bush about it. You know, yeah. I mean, you know, unless inflation becomes, you know, highly entrenched, and this is a rerun of, you know, of the 1970s at some level, eventually they're going to play the negative rates card because they don't want housing prices to fall. And I know that's sort of sacrilege now that, you know, it's all just inflation. But let me put it this way, forever is a long time.
Forever is indeed a long time. And we know that APRA is quietly working with the banks to make sure that they can actually have their systems running in a negative interest rate environment. I think that's due, was it middle of next year, as I recall, last time I looked at it. And, you know, look at the old ECB, who's ahead of us.
Well, that's a bit scary, isn't it? The ECB being ahead of anyone.
Well, they're playing the negative interest rate game at the moment, right? So, it's interesting that they've been very coy about, you know, interest rate rises and reducing stimulus. They might be doing a little bit of the margin, but if you look carefully, all the banks in Europe continue to be supported by money from the ECB. So basically, why don't you just cut out the middleman and just get the ECB to directly pay the profits to the shareholders of the bankers and just have done with it?
Oh, why don't we just eliminate the middleman's middleman and just, you know, get Christine Lagarde out there with a couple of Blackhawks full of euros and just, you know, fly over the cities. Merry Christmas!
You know? Oh, that's the full meaning of helicopter money, right? That's exactly what it means.
Oh, well, I mean, I said a few weeks ago on Twitter that, you know, that basically the ECB isn't going to do anything until Christine Lagarde's in the south of France, and people are paying for their ice creams with wheelbarrows full of euros.
Yes. Merry Christmas, folks.
Okay, now this one I just find fascinating, especially given, you know, the broader mood of financial markets, and the average drawdown from the year-to-date heights for stocks is just, in the S&P 500, not too bad. It's technically avoided a bear market by the narrowest of margins on an average stock basis, but the Nasdaq and the Russell 2000 on an average stock basis have been absolutely smashed. You know, it just goes to show how much these indices are held up both by passive money flows, which just, you know, you buy the index, therefore you're buying the biggest stock in the largest degree, but also just how things are. If you're just an average stockholder, if you've just gone out there and you've gone, oh, I'm going to buy stock X, Y, and Z, you're getting whacked. But if you bought the index, you're still doing very, you know, relatively well, even in the current tumultuous times.
Right, and 2 points. One is there's a lot of automated trading going on at the moment, particularly in this volatile environment, right? And most of that trading is actually driven off the indices, right? So you're seeing very significant movements, even on relatively low volumes. The other is, if you look at the composition of the indices, there are a small number of stocks that really are moving strongly up. And I think we showed a chart the other week on that, showing, you know, some of the big tech stocks. But the rest of the market is nowhere near that, which is why the Russell is so far off.
It is. And it just goes to but this has happened before. You know, it's happened during the dot-com bubble, and it's happened prior to that. And it just goes to show just that there is that broad-based weakness. So the market is vulnerable, but by the same token, with all this insanity, you just don't know when it's going to end. You know, it could go on for longer. You could see these stocks get smashed even harder. You know, you could see, you know, like other parts of the index down, you know, 50% potentially in some cases, yet the index itself is still rising. And it's just, but you know, that's the world of funny money that we live in.
Well, the point there is, and this is the critical point, right? These indices are actually not helpful, right? Because they are artifice that are constructed by people who are actually then betting on the trajectory of the index. And they've got a whole series of business models based on the movements within the index. It's a bit like the house price index in Australia, right? It doesn't really tell you very much at all, but there are people making money off it all the time. I think what we should do is turn off all the indices.
Well, what would all the commentators on CNBC talk about?
Well, I seem to manage to make up stuff all the time now without talking about very much in particular. So, look, the point is this. We've got ourselves into this sort of self-perpetuation machine where you're chasing the latest index up, down, sideways, whatever it is, on sort of an almost hourly basis, right? And then you've got all the chartists who basically then, you know, tell you about all these wonderful, you know, up patterns, down patterns, top bounds, whatever it is, right? And the interesting question with the chartists is, well, is it self-perpetuating or is it just following the trend? But if you stand back and think about it, and you took out of circulation all the chartists, and you took out of circulation all those who are just trading the index, and you looked at the fundamental philosophy of stocks, which is that you've got individuals and small businesses owning bits of big businesses, and those big businesses are trying to share the value back to the small businesses, that was where the stock market started. We've gone so far off that. We've gone into this speculation machine, which means that really it's all out of control.
Yeah, but have you seen Elon Musk's latest tweets? I mean, clearly, you know, that's the most important thing. No. You know, whatever Elon Musk tweets, that's the market at this point. I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, sometimes you see, you know, the market being held up, you know, by its fingernails, and it's Tesla holding on because of something that Elon Musk has said. And it's just, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I wasn't there, you know, trading stocks 200 years ago or 300 years ago during, you know, the South Sea bubble or whatever. You know, it's just, I mean, what is the madness of men?
Well, look at the rail mania in the UK, right, in the time of the Victorian era, right? You had exactly the same stuff going on with massive speculation in building railways to nowhere. It's a remarkable story, again, of the capitalist engine just going off, you know, on its own, as it were. But unfortunately, we seem to worship that particular structure. And I come back to all the time to, so how does this benefit the broader society? How does it actually help us, you know, as a community to actually grow and develop? And okay, people say, well, it makes everybody richer. Well, I'm not sure it makes everybody richer. It makes some people richer. It makes a lot of people having to pay a lot more for things. But we, you know, I do think we've lost the plot here in terms of what this is all about, right? And then you get the algos over the top, which basically are computer trading and, you know, doing very fast trades and on even on minute turns sometime. And so you've got a lot of people spending a lot of money to get even quicker to be able to trade the volatility. And at the end of the day, it doesn't help anybody, right? The answer, of course, is a financial transaction tax.
Well, there is that. There is, I mean, it's a really interesting situation that we're in more broadly, I think, because we are just reliant on the wealth effect. You know, you look at, you know, say for example, you know, say spending by the bottom 95% of people in real terms. You know, like say in the US following the financial crisis, that was flat for years. You know, yet the top 5%, it went to the moon. And that's really where we're at right now. We're at a sort of pseudo feudal society where if you're on the top or, you know, the top part of the middle, you're doing pretty all right. But by the same token, you don't, I mean, say for example, here in Australia, you know, they say, oh, one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Does it really matter? Okay. You know, Bob and Beryl's house is worth $1 million now. Great. What are they going to do with it? Oh, they need somewhere to live. How much is another house? Oh, it's $1 million. Are Bob and Beryl really better off? Well, no, but we can all pat ourselves on the back and write all these lovely articles about how fantastic it is that their homes are worth so much money, and then we can all gather around barbecues and compare how much our houses have gone up. Even though, unless you're a property investor, it's basically meaningless unless you want to move somewhere significantly cheaper because of the cost of transacting. Yeah. It's just silly.
Well, you basically, it's all paper money, it's all on paper only until you've actually got to sell, you don't know. And as you say, you've got to buy somewhere else. I just want to pick you up on your to the moon, right? I'm just fascinated by Musk and, you know, Bezos and a couple of others. They're all building spaceships to go somewhere else.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, you know, if you've got, If we can, you know, advance and, you know, go find some utopian planet to stuff up another time, I mean, I suppose that's preferable, isn't it? I mean, than being here and, you know, watching everything unfold. I mean, without going off on too much of a tangent, I'll get this very brief, but I mean, I think it's kind of ironic that if you ask people, is deforestation bad? Yes. Do you want to stop it? Yes. Do you want to stop overfishing? Yes. You know, there's all these things that, you know, probably 85, 90, 95% of people agree on, and then we don't do anything about it because, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say anything, you know, defamatory at this point, but I mean, you know, why are we not doing something if 95% of people want action on it? It's just stupid.
Because it's the wrong 95%.
So what you're saying is if it was the 95% of the top 1%, then it would be a very different story.
Well, you know, I'm going to go on my rant now. I keep talking about the Davos mob, right? You know, the people who are actually connected with these large multinational organizations and connected with these international organizations, they all get together and they sort of, you know, all pat each other on the head and say, haven't we done well? And we you know, put out these policies. But it's completely disconnected from reality. And the problem is that that's where a lot of the money is, a lot of the influence is. But it's actually without any real accountability. And, you know, the sorts of things that you talked about, you know, things like deforestation and those sorts of things or education, you know, there are so many things that we should be investing in and focusing on. It's not on their agenda. So I'm afraid that it's the wrong 95%.
Well, so it's just on the topic of education for a moment, you know, let's just look at that in the context of say, climate change, which is something that the Davos crew claims they care a whole bunch about when they all rock up in their private jets. Now, one of the biggest issues with climate change is population growth. It's the elephant in the room, you know. And one of the greatest ways to reduce population growth is education, particularly the education of women, you know, because, you know, that you know, for we can go into all the sociological reasons, but that's just the basic long and short of it. So one of the greatest things we could do to affect climate change, particularly in the long term as places like Africa industrialize, is educating women. We could spend money on that. And in the long term, we could, you know, the Davos crew, rather than pissing money away on whatever the crap things that they want to do, that could have a significant impact on climate change. And you'd also have a great, much more educated populace and more scientists and more people who can come to, you know, create all these fantastic things, you know, and you'd have a more educated populace to influence better governance, you know, more engagement, all those lovely things, which would be great for everyone. But no. No, we don't talk about that. We talk about all this other stuff. So all the Davos crew can pat themselves on the back as they're on their way home with their on their private jet with their 14 supermodels and their bed made of money.
Well, you know, you've hit the nail exactly on the head. One of the reasons why DFA exists is because we don't think the mainstream is doing a really good job of helping people to understand what's really going on and to talk about some of these issues. I mean, I've believed passionately that education and helping people to see the world as it really is really critical, because you can't just take it from off the shelf from one of the mainstream media sources and say, see, it's all there, because they're actually giving you a very, very myopic view of what's really going on. And, you know, so many of the things that we could be doing aren't necessarily completely beyond our ken if there was a policy and a willingness to embrace them. So my point is there are decisions that people are taking, both at the political and a structural level. They could take different decisions, but it's in their own interest not to take those decisions. And that's the problem I have. There's too much self-interest and there's too many decisions being taken for the benefit of the 1% or maybe the 5% rather than, everybody else. And I make the final point, Tariq, that if you think about, you know, we're on one planet, right? Well, you know, some small proportion of people on this planet is eating three planet's worth of resources at the moment, and you've got a whole bunch of people with a much lower level of consumption. Isn't it obvious that that can't go on?
Well, it is obvious, but you know, I mean, it's sort of emblematic of humanity to think that unsustainable situations are sustainable. I mean, what is it? It's like the 14th century scenario, you know. You know, where we basically had more and more population, more and more growth. Everyone thought that the good times would go on forever. And then we just got absolutely smacked. And that's what happens to us, to humanity. It's what always happens to us eventually.
Yeah, you know, have you heard about the story of Easter Island, you know, in the middle of the Pacific? It's a remarkable story, right? Because basically it was a very prosperous area and they had lots of trees. And so they spent a lot of time cutting down the trees and suddenly they had no more trees. And then their population blew up because basically there was nothing to build houses and things. And so they built all these stone idols and things, but the whole economy just crashed. I mean, in a way, that's exactly. Or Douglas Adams talked about the shoe event horizon, where effectively everybody's just, building shoe shops and selling shoes, and eventually nothing else happens other than selling shoes until the economy collapses. It's whether you look at fiction or fact, that's the story.
Well, I quite like the Easter Island one actually, because you know we've made our idols. We've got Jerome, and then we've got Christine, and we've got Phil. You know, and that we pray to them that they keep the never ending tap sort of milk and honey going to keep the plates spinning, and you know, and if they stop, we risk the wrath of the gods, and that's pretty much where we're at actually, because if you take all that central bank intervention away, you're going to have a very painful adjustment, but I must say a necessary one.
I love it. I reckon that should be one of those cartoons with the Easter Island.
Yeah. I should tag them on Twitter and see if they can put that together.
that'd be good. But yeah, you're right. And of course, the interesting thing is that the mainstream media wait for those gods to deliver their latest missive, right? As though, you know, somehow it's coming in tablets of stone, and you know, we've got to listen to what these people say because they know everything, and that's why they don't ask any good questions.
Should probably get on to the next slide, otherwise this is going to be like a 3-hour special.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. not just you, mate. It's both of us. Okay. Now, this one I think is an interesting paradox, because it's very much counterintuitive. And it's basically that when you hit full employment, a recession usually follows not too long after, because you're hitting that point where inflation results, and eventually inflation needs to be tamed. And part of inflation, taming inflation, is unemployment. For better or worse, that's the way that the system has been created. And guess what? We're very, very close to full employment in the US, and we're approaching that here in Australia, probably get relatively close to that next year, depending on whose full employment target you put stock in. And well, you know, that's where we're at. And you know, that risks that inflationary feedback loop of higher wages that we were referring to earlier.
Yeah, with a caveat, of course, that we now define employment differently. So there's a lot of people on very, very low hours, but are still classified as fully employed. So if you were actually to apply the old metrics to employment, we get a very different answer.
Well, to be fair, if you applied the old metrics to inflation, you get a very different answer too.
Funny that.
I mean, the thing is if you apply, you know, the older inflation metrics, you include things like housing prices, you weight things properly, you measure things as they actually are. I mean, we would have had rate hikes long, long ago, both here in Australia and around the world. But, you know, I mean, wealth effect.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Okay. This is the last chart for the day. And there is a lot of hype at the moment surrounding stimulus in China, and, you know, both of the monetary and the fiscal variety. And basically there's this idea, you know, China has cut the benchmark interest rate. You know, this is going to spur this enormous, you know, eventually, you know, they're going to open the floodgates. This is going to spur this huge, you know, wealth effect, this huge increase in borrowing, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality is that the scope really just isn't there for the same type of, you know, cutting of benchmark rates that we saw during the global financial crisis. I mean, you can see on the chart on the left that they slashed rates from around 7.5% to just above 5%, which is a huge, huge amount of rates. Sorry, huge rate cut. Yet if you look on the right, which is the Chinese government bond yield, there's really not that much daylight between Chinese government bond yields and the benchmark interest rates. Now, obviously, banks are much more risky than the Chinese sovereign, so there's going to be the investment grade debt is going to be have a higher cost again. So there just isn't that scope to slash rates by, you know, 2.5% like there was before. Because if they slash rates by 2.5%, the banks are going to go down the tubes and the whole thing will collapse. So it's really much more a case of tinkering around the edges than these big, huge stimuluses that we've become accustomed to from China.
Yeah, and of course they reduced their capital requirements on the banks quite recently to try and actually support things there. And as we said earlier on, they're also, you know, stopping some exports to try and actually support the economy. But then we've got the COVID story in China as well. I think 2022 will be significantly impacted by what China does or doesn't do and how the Chinese economy flows. I don't think it's going to get us out of jail like it did around the global financial crisis.
It is going to be fascinating to watch, because 2022 is a key, I mean, is a politically key year. It's going to be the beginning of President Xi's, you know, more or less unprecedented up until this point in recent decades, his third term as, you know, God Emperor of China. And, you know, he and El Presidente for life. And that's going to really be key, because are we going to see cracks appear in the facade of unity within the Chinese Communist Party? Because we're already seeing local government break with the central government and start throwing stimulus at the housing market, but obviously on a much lower level with the resources that they have to incentivize home buying, to incentivize developers to continue to buy land. And meanwhile, President Xi and the central government, Beijing, are still pushing very much a "we need to address systemic risk" line of things on the property sector. So, you know, there's that real schism, and that's going to be a test of Xi's leadership. You know, is he really the you know, the top dog, completely uncontested? You know, everyone else is far, far behind, and he can do what he likes. Because if that is the case, and he does press on, then 2022 could be quite challenging for Australia. You know, we could be quite, and as due to the challenges that the Chinese property sector will experience, or is his rule actually, you know, a lot more? Is the sort of coalition behind him more fragmented You know, is there division there? Because that could force Xi into some concessions, and we could see some greater degree of stimulus. So it's going to be really interesting to watch.
Absolutely. And I'll just draw a parallel here between the states and the federal government, right? I'm not sure who's the god emperor. We could discuss that on another occasion, perhaps. But the fact is that the states are going one way and the Fed's going somewhere else different. And I'm not sure that they're actually all pulling in the same direction either, which, again, will be quite interesting in terms of seeing how 2022 plays out. And I suppose we should sort of reflect on the election will either be in March or May, depending on presumably what happens with Omicron over the next 2 or 3 weeks.
It is going to be interesting. I'm just going to stop sharing this. Well, okay. It's going to be quite interesting because on one hand, an election sooner is preferable for a number of different reasons because, you know, there's the uncertainty heading into, you know, the cooler months of, you know, what's going to potentially happen with the virus. Is there going to be issues with seasonality? Well, there will be issues with seasonality, but to what degree? And there's also the fact that the longer ScoMo waits, the more chance that there is that Phil Lowe could rain on his parade and potentially hike interest rates, which would be, you know, quite a blow to
quite Morrison. Amusing.
Well, yeah, it would be amusing. I mean, to be honest, I would literally pay money to see that. You know, if Phil, call me. It is interesting in that regard because, you know, if we do see the Fed hike rates, if we do see, you know, like these price pressures flowing in and you know, economic data remains relatively solid in the US, you know, we could see the Fed raise rates in March. And if the election isn't until May here in Australia and you're seeing, you know, interest rate hikes throughout the Anglosphere, if we see particularly the Bank of Canada raise interest rates as well, you know, you could see fairly significant pressure build on Phil Lowe, particularly if we do see an uptick in wages, which will, you know, hopefully occur. So, you know, it's going to be a really, really interesting one to watch because, you know, if ScoMo waits, that there are risks whether he does it in March or whether he does it later. So all I know is that there's apparently a $16 billion cash splash coming from the government, which is, I forget exactly what the acronym is, but it's basically, it's policy costed but not announced yet.
Correct.
So we're just going to have to wait
slush
and see
fund.
We just have to wait and see what exactly they're going to try and.
Yeah. Well, that's why I believe some of it will go into property, right? I'm sure that they'll do something to try and actually, just support the property sector a bit longer. And if they then lose the next election and Labour gets in, Labour will have a hell of a dilemma because they either have to sort of turn it back again or they are stuck with it. So it will be interesting to see. I mean, I think 2022 is going to be another roller coaster year. I don't think that I can see a way out of that. So many different factors in play. And Tarek, I've really enjoyed speaking with you through the year. Thank you very much for your insights and your charts. And we'll do it all again next year, right?
Yep. I'm looking forward to it, mate.
And season's greetings to you and yours.
Yeah, same to you, mate.
And to all our viewers too. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.